and then we'll come back and hear item 9. So with that,
yes, thank you, Chairman Hales, and good morning, good afternoon, fellow board members. Won't hold you long for lunch here, and I will warn you in advance, I don't have any ooey-gooey pictures of blue-green algae, cyanobacteria, scums to spoil your lunch. But I didn't do that on purpose, but I realize it's going to be a good thing. Today, the purpose of this presentation is to apprise the board of the nature and extent of this issue in the North Coast. It's really a general overview informational item. You can see here the presentation topics, which is really a series of questions that probably would occur to you when thinking about where do we go from here on this topic. I gave this presentation, a similar presentation, to the State Board on July 6th. They had asked for an update. And because North Coast Region has had the most experience, they came to us and asked us. So this is slightly modified because, really, you guys are ahead of the curve on this issue because we have had more of this issue in the North Coast Region. But I did include some of the background information. But we're going to cover very briefly what is cyanobacteria, what conditions contribute to cyanobacteria blooms, where are the most current North Coast blooms occurring? How are we responding to cyanobacteria blooms? And what are staff recommendations moving forward? And you notice that I'm using the term cyanobacteria because as education evolves on this, it is really, it's commonly called blue-green algae. But in fact, it is an ancient life form that has been with us for eons. In fact, many people think that blue-green algae is responsible for a lot of the oxygen that's in the atmosphere today. It does have chlorophyll and is capable of photosynthesis, but it is truly a bacteria. And so part of the evolution of our understanding of this, we get a lot of calls on green algae, people thinking it's blue-green algae, when in fact it's cyanobacteria that we're concerned with, not green algae in most cases. So it occurs naturally in most water bodies at or below detection levels. And therefore, when I was looking up definitions to provide you, one of the definitions says it is the cockroach of the aquatic world. And that rings true here because cockroaches have always been present for a great period of time. And really, it's the conditions, the background conditions, that cause them to become a nuisance. And it struck me that that's very true for blue-green algae, as you'll see. And so I included that analogy here. So what are those background conditions under which we see nuisance blooms when cyanobacteria becomes the dominant aquatic life form rather than a background below detection life form? And we've learned a lot about this in the North Coast region. We see the conditions and factors contributing to these nuisance blooms to be nutrient-enriched waters, warm or hot weather with high water temperature. Lakes and reservoirs are the predominant environment in which we see this occur because its preferred habitat is quiescent, still waters. But we have seen it in streams and streams and rivers with low flows. And this largely comes from sediment impairments and diminished riparian cover. So this really ties with Brian, although we didn't even speak about our presentations. There is an overlap here of these issues, and it relates to blue-green cyanobacteria blooms as well. Our blooms occur, typically they start in June or July, and they persist through October or November when either rainfall events or fall overturn of the reservoirs disrupts the cycle. And just for background, we posted a health advisory at Copco Reservoir on June 25th. So that gives you some idea of the timing there. Okay, where have these been occurring? Where have we documented blooms? And when documented is an important term here because it means we worked with local agencies, we ourselves, we collected samples, identified that it was above thresholds of concern, and either posted a public press release or health notices or a health advisory. And you can see here that we're all familiar with all of the listings, and this doesn't represent all of them by any stretch of the imagination. I was just simply trying to show that the Klamath has been posted at many times at many locations, in particular at the reservoirs Kopko and Iron Gate. But in addition to that, we've seen last summer on the Van Dusen River, the South Fork of the Eel, both in Humboldt and Mendocino County. And here locally in Santa Rosa, we've had some occurrences of blue-green algae, cyanobacteria blooms at two ponds along the Russian River and also at a private pond here in Sonoma County. And the landowner was very cooperative in terms of our response to that as well. So we're beginning to see, the point is, we're beginning to see more of this. People are starting to recognize it, local public health agencies, and we're beginning to get a lot of calls about it. Oops. Oh, I've got John Bishop here going. I'm quite capable of that on my own. How to respond to blooms? Well, we do have draft statewide guidance, and just yesterday, and I don't know whether to call it still draft or not, but a revised edition. It was first drafted in 2007. There was an update in 2008. And now another update here in 2010. And it'll probably be updated again in a year because we're learning so much each summer's experience in using this guidance for how to respond to blooms. But the State Board has been instrumental in organizing statewide efforts to create this guidance so that we have some consistency, Kim Ward. But several other agencies, including agencies from other states, Oregon Department of Health, has been a cooperative participant as well. And I'd be remiss in saying that the tribes have had a lot of input because of all of their experience, scientific and otherwise, in dealing with this. So this guidance is available at the State Board website that's listed there. So the state guidance is based on a two-tiered approach. And we kind of fall in the middle of states in terms of how we respond to this. California's is a two-tiered approach. Our first approach is educational and informational, distributing pamphlets at campgrounds and water entry areas where in the past we've had experiences of blooms. And we work with local public health agencies to do this. I'll be discussing in a moment, we have a monitoring program, and when we're alerted to a bloom, we confirm that the presence of that bloom and the presence of cyanobacteria species above thresholds, then we move to another level, and that is when these monitoring thresholds are exceeded. And we post it with not just information about it, but we actually advise people to avoid contact with the water and provides cautions on consumption of the fish and mussels because there is, we do have evidence that it does accumulate in tissue and can be ingested that way as well. And so this is really appropriate where blooms are occurring. And those stars sort of show you where we have already taken this health advisory action. So when we document the blooms, how are we tracking this thing? Well, in the Klamath River, we have a very sophisticated and well-funded monitoring program, and this is through the Klamath Hydropower Settlement Agreement. There are blue-green algae sampling protocols, sampling criteria for public health and for environmental. And so we have a very good system up and down the river. 2 weeks, we get both cell counts and toxin levels, and that's the top end of what we know and how we do it. Generally, though, because of we just rely on the presence of scums, and when we say it's not just if somebody reports a scum, we have to have somebody with some training, and several of our public health officers have had this training to confirm that scum is composed largely of blue-green algae or cyanobacteria. So the identification of cyanobacteria species in samples, we do cell counts. So we actually, there are several different species that produce these toxins, and there is taxonomy for identifying particular species. It's not easy. I've been at it for 2 years. I consider mine to be a very rough level of skill at doing this. We also have Steve Butkus here on staff. He provides a lot of assistance to me. We lost Elmer Dudick, who, of course, had a tremendous amount of skill in this area, and we have yet to come up to our former level with that. They also measure cyanotoxins, which requires taking a water sample. And there's a common protocol for this, but it's very expensive, and there are very few machines that actually measure this toxin. So, and there's also, of course, then the exposure delay, because there's a week turnover between the time you take the sample and when you get the results back. So we do pursue, when we can, getting the actual measurement of the toxin, but we can't wait to post until we receive that information. And generally, with most species, there's a very high correlation between the cell counts and toxin concentration. That's not always true, though. And in fact, this last bloom on Copco was a Anabina floesequia, which has an antitoxin associated with it. We had very high cell counts, over 100,000. Came back that we got the toxin concentration back about a week and a half later, and it was non-detect. So that's unusual, but not unheard of. So you can see we have some risk liability issues here, and the amount of information that we have to work with often causes us to err on the side of public health risk. So for each bloom event, we coordinate with local entities, and that's generally public health departments. I have to say Humboldt County and Sonoma County have just been exemplary. They're just been a joy to work with. And we do this because oftentimes does the regional board take the lead, or does the public health department want to take the lead? And so that varies from event to event, but we coordinate with them on these response. We also have landowners and parks. The Sonoma County Parks has been outstanding in terms of their response to these when it occurs within their parklands. And then, of course, we work very closely with the tribes on this. And the Forest Service has been, they help us. You know, we don't have the manpower to get all the advisories out to campgrounds. A lot of these agencies have contributed in terms of staff time. We send them an electronic version of the advisory, and they get them out for us. So we prepare that in coordination with them. We prepare these informational materials or posting advisories, and then we work with them to get them posted. And then we also alert statewide through a press release, and we coordinate with state board staff, again, have been instrumental. I don't even know how to do this, but Dave Klegren works his magic and gets it out to our listserv, to all the newspapers, and it gets out the day that we actually post. That's done. So there's a fair amount of coordination that goes on with these events. So as a wrap-up, we are experiencing, you know, an increasing frequency of cyanobacteria blooms and related incidents. Now, someone on the staff yesterday asked, is this because people are starting to recognize it more, or are we seeing more of this? And I would say that our impaired streams, there's an increased frequency that is going to happen. I mean, it's based on the principle of how this stuff works. The fact that we have these impaired streams, it does occur more than it occurred in the past. We don't know that for sure because no one was present back at that time, but generally it's the mechanism that drives it, so we can anticipate more of this, especially with global warming as our streams warm even further. So the regional board staff are working with local agencies on education and posting. We'd like to be doing better, but we're doing all that we can, and it's generally been a very cooperative and good arrangement with the county health boards. The actions that are needed to address this, we really need to, just like cockroaches, you need to address the underlying causes. And those are control nutrient loading, restore and maintain stream integrity, which means riparian canopy and not sediment impaired. And we need to regulate flows because as the streams slow down, they warm up, they create quiescent waters, and that's where this stuff will occur. So, any questions?
Thanks, Clayton. Yeah, I have a couple, actually. First, when we were had last been updated on this and where things were going and some discussions that I've had, there was a lot of statewide push to advance the science for setting numeric criteria. We were going off of World Health Organization guidelines and numeric thresholds with what might be considered a health risk. And can you touch briefly on how that's advanced and where we might be in learning a little bit more about when we can set an actual criteria for that?
So HEA continues to work on that,
yeah.
And we are waiting, to be honest. That's the one part about the state board that's become a black hole, is we're not sure why it stuck. And we got draft guidance on for livestock, small animals, and people, and that's what we've been going by.
Off of that.
The World Health Organization standards appear to be, actually conservative in some cases compared to the OHEA guidelines. Hmm. And so I didn't want to show them here because they're still draft and they haven't released their final recommendations yet. On the Klamath, of course, what we were able to do was correlate very nicely the chlorophyll A concentrations, which, as you recall, was one of our targets, with nutrient concentrations, with cell counts for microcystis, and then the microcystin concentration. When we established a very clear relationship between all of those variables, and we know that very well for the Klamath. We don't know that for other species. We don't know that for other systems, and we don't really have any research in place right now to explore that further. It took a lot of effort on the part of the tribes to collect a tremendous amount of water quality data to be able to develop that, but that's why we were able to establish really probability estimates for the frequency of nuisance blooms, was because we did have so much of that nutrient and chlorophyll A and blue-green algae data.
Thanks. I guess the last question I have was kind of a smaller one. When you showed the map of the occurrences, I didn't see Big Lagoon on there. Has that been, and just living in that particular part of the region, have there been documented cases there, or is that, or do you know?
I don't know.
Okay. I thought that I'd heard that in the past, and I thought it had been brought up at a county level, but just
I also wonder. I thought also Freshwater Lagoon, where I've certainly seen 3 or 4 years ago a huge algae scum mat. And I think that may be
not to try to point out that you're missing stars on your map here, but just more.
Yeah.
Just
what I mean by documented is that these are the ones that we were able, for example, I got a call for Spring Lake that it was a Friday furlough, and it's not that I wouldn't have gone in, but I was actually out of town. And by the time I got in there Monday to take the sample, it had already receded to the point that I couldn't detect it. Mm-hmm. So when I say documented, these are ones we actually coordinated with health departments or local agencies, got samples, got them analyzed, and was able then to post on based on that information. We've been getting a lot of calls from a lot of people that we're actually not able to respond to.
I just had one other thought, too, is I had heard earlier there was certain studies that the wavelength band was extremely distinct for some of the species, and so actually a proper interpretation of the satellite photographs on Google Earth could actually produce fairly accurate probabilities of the existence of to guide site checks.
I'm unfamiliar with that. I can look into that. Steve Butkus on our staff has been tracking a phylochip technology that does genetic identification of the various toxicity species, and I don't have much information on it. Steve, do you have anything do you want to say about the phylochip? Okay, there is some when I say phylochip, it's like a datasond type of technology where it's in place, and that would be ideal, because as you can see, if you don't get out there in time or you aren't able to get out there to get a sample, so what we're looking for is in situ type of sampling that would give us you know, this sort of 24-hour monitoring capability in areas where we suspect, you know, the frequency of blooms to occur.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Massey.
Can you run through, because the microcystin is a toxin, correct?
Yes, microcystin is the toxin associated with the microcystin.
And distinguish then why the blue-green algae is an impairment to beneficial uses more than, say, any other scum mat that appears out there on the water.
I'm regretting taking out
nice scum mats.
I'm regretting taking out my state board slides now, and I apologize for that. The not all blue-green algae, not all cyanobacteria create toxins, and many species do. And so blue-green algae can impair beneficial uses in many ways other than just toxins. Okay, so when a blue-green algae bloom occurs, it becomes the dominant life form, and they can control their buoyancy, and they form these thick scum on top of the water. And so it's aesthetic, it's contact, and it can also actually block sunlight from entering the water column and can affect food web processes below that. And when it crashes, all of that organic matter floats to the bottom and then goes through a decomposition process, which uses oxygen, and you frequently see dissolved oxygen crashes once the organic matter begins decomposition. So you can, there's a whole series of beneficial use impairments there. There's potential toxicity if the species is correct. There's the aesthetic and contact, and then there's the food web processes and the dissolved oxygen depletion that occurs as a result of that. Is that? So virtually all of our, I mean, and then there's the cultural use. I mean, the toxicity affects virtually all of our beneficial uses.
Thank you.
But just to speak to the toxicity, and I should have included that slide, is, you know, there are anatoxins, which are neurotoxins. They're very fast-acting, and the Van Dusen and the eel both had dog deaths associated with them. Unfortunately, the owners had already disposed of their carcass before we were able to get a tissue sample. But the we have the water column identification, and we have the dog's response, which was the anatoxin, which is convulsions within an hour after leaving the water body. So we suspect that that was the Anabaena flosaquia or the anatoxin. Then you also have the hepatoxins produced by microcystis, which is more of a chronic. You wouldn't, unless you had a massive dose, it wouldn't cause a fatality. But over time, it disrupts liver function by impacting the manner in which cellular membrane can transport the heme molecule back and forth across the membrane. So the cells become engorged, and it disrupts the physical structure of the liver. So microcystis has a very microcystin has a very characteristic pathology that is literally unique to it. And so when you see a liver sample with this disrupted physical structure, the capillary, you know, if livers work because they have this capillary action, when that gets disrupted, then the liver no longer functions. So it's not, it's a kind of a physical toxicity almost, as opposed to a, you know, chemical toxicity.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Norton.
By the way, thanks for being on the front of the curve here, Clayton. I mean, this is very, very important stuff. Can I ask, though, a couple things? The Klamath was listed for microcystin, correct?
It was. EPA came in mid-cycle.
And so it's listed for the toxin, not for the presence of the cyanobacteria itself.
That's correct. And Matt might be able to speak to that. There was some sensitivity about whether or not, you know, a naturally occurring organism could be considered a 303D listing.
Sure. At your discretion. I mean, it's a general question. The other thing, when you mentioned 100, you said a cell count of 100,000. Is that 100,000 per 100 mil, kind of MPN number per 100 mil thing?
Yeah, I'm sorry. 100,000 per milliliter, and that is for...
Per mil.
Yeah, per mil. And that is for that particular species. For microcystis, it's our threshold is 40,000. And the only reason it's not lower for the Anabina flos aqueous just simply because of we don't have enough information about the relationship between cell count and toxin. But if you're at 100,000, you're experiencing a nuisance bloom, which has all those other associated, the dissolved oxygen crash, the aesthetic, all of those things are occurring.
So just briefly, it's because of that variability in the relationship between cell count and presence of the toxin that the ultimately EPA decided, and I think it's appropriate, that it's the toxin, it's the presence of the toxin that's causing an impairment to the beneficial use. It's presenting a public health risk as well as potential risk for wildlife. So that's why it's the toxin that is identified as the impairment, not the algal species themselves.
Clayton, it also strikes me in looking at just this response that's happened, because it's all the way through. It is a water quality issue for sure, but I mean it's a health issue, it's a public health issue, it's a contact sport, all that kind of thing. How do we sit then in the kind of level of agency response here? It seems to me that some of it is very much a public health posting issue and a notification thing, but then the water quality issue must push us back to the top.
Yeah, by default, our name is out there on the posters. And we're
called Clayton Krager.
That's right. Actually, it is. Yeah.
Target.
No. And we are on the front line, and we'll probably remain so because of that. And it's and the public health agencies don't want it, actually. So.
Well, on the other side of this, too, I mean, it strikes me that the cyanobacteria and the microcystin toxin, kind of suite of toxins that go with it, they're a symptom. They're a symptom of conditions that go along with, like you said, that those warm water, nutrient loading, quiescent water. And, you know, I guess my concern is, you know, it looks like it's kind of throughout the region. It sounds like it's an indigenous life form that's present on Earth, probably in a whole lot of places, but yet not being expressed until conditions get there. So, and I think about the Russian, you know, here we are with the Russian. We started the day with Brenda Edelman came and, you know, I remember her pictures had certain amount of floating bacteria and that kind of stuff. And so my concern is then is conditions of the Russian that go from everywhere from free flowing at Squaw Rock, pretty good moving, you ride a kayak through it, to estuary conditions and very low flow and actually nutrient impairment on the lower Russian. So it's potentially in our backyard, I could imagine.
Yeah, if you go back to Brian's maps where he was showing temperature and sediment impairments, generally you're going to also have flow impairments at those locations, and you're going to have nutrient impairments, and we'll see a high level of correlation. And just to go back for a moment to the listings, by definition, even if we don't get the microcystin count or the toxin count, if you post an advisory for not use, by definition, that's an impairment that's going to have to be mentioned in the next 303D listing cycle. I mean, it's you're not using it. So
yeah, and I got to admit, my family and I went up to Standishickey last year and went, you know, we're swimming in the swimming hole on the river, and there's a posting. I believe it was a posting for that, My concern again is just that, you know, as you look at things like the Russian and the conditions that are being changed out there, I just wonder if it drives us a little bit further towards that list. And
yeah.
do we? And then a follow up to that would be, if that is in fact a potential, is then the water quality testing being done out there also including this type of aspect of blue green algae testing? And maybe that's not for you, but just holistically thinking about testing out there, it's a conundrum.
Yeah, we don't have anywhere close to the monitoring resources right now to know the full extent of how much of this is occurring, and we're really relying on, you know, citizen complaints when they see scums, and oftentimes they're scums that are green algae that, you know, might naturally occur and not present really any problem, but. We don't have any way to follow up on all of them.
Well, last thing is that, you know, it seems like it's my standard line these days, but, it, you know, come back and talk to us about it as this goes. As more information comes, I would ask that you update this board and, you know, how do we deal with this? How do we stay ahead of it? Because it sounds like it's rather, it's daunting, it's fast-paced, and it looks like it's a common thing.
Now, I'd be remiss in not pointing out that the state board asked for the same thing, an update, you know, as more information becomes available. And so I committed to that.
Well, thanks, Clayton. Yep. Thank you very much.
Any other board member comments? Okay, I do have a speaker card from Ms. Edelman, who I think will lead us into lunch as she kicked us off in the meeting this morning. So,
Brenda Edelman, Russian River Watershed Protection Committee, and I want to pick up on the comments that David was just making, and that is going back to my photographic report. The worst algae that I saw in the areas I was looking at was at the Monterio Children's Beach, which is a very, very high-use area. It's a whole recreational area there. And the pictures were pretty gross, and I didn't think to ask someone to test it until in October 5th, I got word they were going to open the mouth of the river, so I got down there real fast to get pictures and then went down the following day to get new pictures to see the difference between before and after the mouth opening. And the area that had, the whole area was just filled with algae, and I happened to send an email to John Short telling him about it and requesting that they test for blue-green algae, and they actually, your staff actually did that, and about a week later I got a report back saying it tested positive. I unfortunately don't have the email with me, but I do have it at home. John probably can access it. So, in other words, there was a positive reading at that location, and I would really appreciate some kind of follow-up this year because it's a high-use area. I also received a few reports of dogs dying and having the kind of reaction that Creighton described, and that happened in Forestville, I was told, around the Steelhead Beach area. So I think this is a very serious problem, and I'm deeply concerned about it. I don't have the sense that it's prevalent all up and down the river. I haven't heard enough reports to get that feeling, but I do know that Monterio Children's Beach area, just based on these pictures, and you can look them up at our website, www.rrwpc.org, and see the report, and you'll see those pictures are really, really gross. So anyway, I just urge, in the interest of public health, I hope that you will follow through this year. So far, we have not had the really low flows. These pictures were taken at very low flow, and most of the algae is sort of covered up right now. I don't think it's a big problem yet, but I think it will be as the summer continues. Thank you.
Thank you, Brenda. Anybody else? Okay, we're going to take a lunch break, and we'll come back at 1:45. I don't think that. At my vice chairman's urging, I bang the gavel. Thank you.
That's what he's here for.
Okay, welcome back, everybody. Well, without any further ado, let's hop right on to item number 9.